Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, lawmakers may have a plan for Medicare reform by the end of the week, including privatization and a prescription drug benefit.
The shadow prescription drug industry in the U.S. is booming, even if the consequences can be lethal.
Reports say some NASA scientists tried to halt last weekend's launch to the space station.
There was so many problems with onboard sensors that are designed to provide NASA with real-time assessment of air quality and water quality and levels of radiation, that they said, no, we can't support this mission.
An amateur athlete tries performance-enhancing drugs. His advice, don't do it.
These stories and Boston's Jordan Hall coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Representatives of 70 nations are meeting in Madrid to discuss the reconstruction of Iraq. The UN estimates it will cost up to $55 billion over 4 years to restore the country's basic infrastructure. From Madrid, NPR's Guy Raz reports.
Though there is widespread support for the reconstruction of Iraq, the platitudes and statements here in Madrid may not add up to the billions of dollars the White House hopes to raise to help the country. The U.S. will shoulder about a third of the estimated reconstruction costs, but so far, less than $3 billion in grants have been pledged by other countries. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan opened today's conference by appealing to the participants.
I appeal to donors to give and give generously, and for those contributions to be provided in addition to existing commitments.
France and Germany say they'll hold off on contributing more aid to Iraq until the issue of Iraqi sovereignty is resolved. Guy Raz, NPR News, Madrid.
President Bush wrapped up a six-nation tour of Asian and Pacific allies today in Australia. He thanked Prime Minister John Howard for his support in the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The president ran into some anti-war protesters, both inside and outside the Australian Parliament, but he made no apologies, asking who can possibly think the world would be better off with Saddam Hussein still in power. The president and Mrs. Bush are now on their way to Hawaii. Federal officials have arrested what they believe are more than 300 illegal workers at 61 Walmart stores across the country. Those arrested were members of cleaning crews hired through a contractor. They were taken into custody as they were finishing their night shifts at Walmart stores in 21 states. A power outage has delayed the trial of suspected sniper John Muhammad in Virginia Beach, Virginia. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Court officials say an underground transformer blew, forcing a day's delay in the Muhammad trial. They say it will take all day and night to perform repairs. It's not clear what caused the outage, but authorities say it was not the dozen or so TV satellite trucks that flanked the courthouse. The trial was moved to Virginia Beach so that a jury less affected by the Washington area sniper shootings could be found. Muhammad is charged in the death last October of 53-year-old Dean Myers, who was shot at a Manassas, Virginia gas station. There may also be a delay in the trial of the other sniper suspect, Lee Boyd Malvo. His was to begin next month in nearby Chesapeake, Virginia. Prosecutors have asked for more time to give their mental health experts a chance to examine Malvo, whose attorneys say they plan to present an insanity defense. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 20 points at this hour, the Nasdaq down 17, the S&P down 1. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, new claims for jobless benefits dipped to a one-month low last week. The Labor Department reports new applications declined by a seasonally adjusted 4,000 to 386,000. That is the lowest level since September, and it's the third week in a row that claims have run below 400,000. A new round of contract talks is underway between unionized grocery workers and management in Arizona. The current label contract expires on Saturday. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Mark Moran reports.
14,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union are set to strike in Arizona if some agreement can't be reached by the weekend on health care and pension benefits. Cuts in Sunday pay and management's plan to offer new workers lower wages and fewer benefits than existing employees. The Fry's and Safeway supermarket chains are advertising for replacement workers in case current employees do take to the picket lines over the weekend, a move the union calls a scare tactic. Grocery store officials say they're just covering their bases in the event of a strike. Thousands of California grocery clerks went on strike earlier this month when their demands weren't met. The two sides still have not reached an agreement. More than 70,000 people are represented by the union in California. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Sara Lee Corporation says its quarterly earnings fell about 25% as the cost of raw materials rose and the food service market slowed. The company says it earned 29 cents a share in the fiscal first quarter. That's 9 cents a share less than last year. Sara Lee makes baked goods, Jimmy Dean sausages, and Champion underwear. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The head of the Medicare program says there's a 95% chance that lawmakers will soon vote to reform Medicare and provide seniors with a program for prescription drugs. Democrats are complaining they've been all but cut out of the debate, but a plan is emerging and it could be ready by the end of the week. Ken Thorpe is chair of the Health Policy Department at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He joins us on the line. Welcome, Professor Thorpe.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's start with a look at the plan as it stands now. Seniors would be offered a prescription drug plan. They'd pay $35 for a monthly premium for prescription drugs, up to $275. The government would pay most of the cost of drugs, up to $2,200. Then there's a donut hole where seniors pay all of their drugs, up to $3,600. After that, the government picks up the entire tab. So, first of all, what are the positive things about this plan?
Well, the positive is that they've come to an agreement on one drug design. That's a plus. I think the negative still is that as you just went through it, it's a complicated plan, yeah. And it's certainly going to be one that, as I try to describe it to my mom, she kind of rolls her eyes because it's still as complicated.
And is it better than the private plans that seniors have enrolled in?
Well, no, and that's one of the problems and points of contention. A plan like you just described would pay 45 to 50% of seniors' drug costs. And typically, a senior who has coverage, let's say, through an employer today, that plan might pay 75 to 80% of drug costs.
Well, what about the plans for, say, my mom, who is also a senior, 80 years old, she has a plan that's run by New York State. Would it be better than that kind of private plan?
Not likely. Again, the employer-based plans that many seniors have are generally more generous.
Well, in order to provide prescription drugs, Medicare, some say, has to save money and must be privatized. Lawmakers want Medicare to compete with private health plans starting in just 7 years. But give us your thoughts on that, given especially that how many seniors can go to private plans when private plans tend to drop seniors?
That's certainly a major concern that many lawmakers have about the reliability of private plans to stay in the market. Certainly, historically, that the track record hasn't been good.
And what would a senior's incentive be to move off of Medicare to a private plan?
Well, there'd be two as the House bill is constructed. One is that they would charge seniors more money to stay in traditional fee-for-service, so it would become more expensive. And secondly, it is possible that the private plans would offer some additional supplemental benefits.
Another concern, aren't there some areas of the country that don't offer private plans? Medicare is the only option for seniors. And then also some worry that the sickest seniors will then be sort of stuck on Medicare, if you will, overloading that system.
Today, about 40% of Medicare beneficiaries have access to no private plans. Now, in the compromise, they would make sure that a private plan would be available every place in the country. But it is true that fee-for-service Medicare under this type of approach probably would become more expensive leaving in it people who are older and likely sicker, paying more for the same set of benefits that they're currently receiving.
Mm. Professor, isn't it true that someone's going to have to pay somewhere along the line for the prescription benefits for seniors?
Well, no doubt. It's at least $400 billion over the next 10 years, and the devil will be in the ultimate details. I think the drug benefit is workable. It's not ideal, but it's something we could probably use it to get going and hopefully improve on.
Mm. Professor, thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Ken Thorpe, Chair of the Health Policy Department at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University.
Well, as Congress wrangles over the Medicare bill and trying to help people pay for prescription drugs, millions of Americans are buying them on the black market, illegally and sometimes lethally. A recent Washington Post series focuses on what it calls a multi-billion dollar shadow market, which sells to some of the most vulnerable among us watered-down cancer drugs, misidentified painkillers easy to overdose on, and fake HIV drugs for victims of AIDS. Gilbert M. Gaul is co-author of the Washington Post series. He joins us now. Welcome, Gilbert.
Thank you.
You know, Americans have always had a lot of trust, it seems to me, in their neighborhood pharmacy. You talk about something you call the gold standard. How's getting drugs just briefly worked in the past, and how was it supposed to work?
Well, in the past, it's been a fairly straightforward transaction where the drug makers, the companies make the products. They distribute them primarily through three primary wholesalers and a number of other smaller and medium-sized wholesalers, and they then sell the drugs down to the retail level, to your corner drugstore or retail chain, and that's where you buy the drug.
Yeah, it was pretty simple, just a couple of companies,
yes.
Really big companies involved. Now, why the emergence of the shadow market?
Well, I mean, I think it's driven by economics in two different ways. I mean, on the one hand, where you have a criminal element, it's driven by individuals who are simply trying to maneuver their way into the legitimate distribution chain and make money. And that's a whole part of the series that we wrote about. It involves drug diverters. And then I think in terms of individuals who go online to buy drugs or are crossing the border to buy drugs, it tends to be an economic decision. In many cases, you know, they're being driven to that type of decision-making by the high price of drugs in the U.S.
So how does the shadow market work? What, for example, is what you just mentioned, a drug diverter?
Uh-huh. Well, that's somebody who is able to insinuate himself into the system. I mean, basically the typical way it works these days is a guy sets up a tiny wholesale drug operation, may be licensed, may not be licensed. He begins to buy drugs that go to what are known as institutional pharmacies or closed-door pharmacies. These are special little pharmacies whose only purpose in life is to acquire drugs. When they do it legitimately, they usually go to nursing homes, AIDS clinics, hospices. The drugs are steeply discounted by the drug makers.
Yeah, so they buy them cheap, and then they They mark them up and sell them back to who?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon. In some cases, it's just a pure form of arbitrage where they just they trade them literally among themselves, depending upon who has a need, who has a buyer. You know, somebody may have another wholesaler who wants to buy the drugs, who's looking to get a deal, because at any point in these transactions, in the circle of these sales, the drug is still going to be cheaper for them to buy than it is if they bought directly from the drug company, okay,
mm-hmm.
or from one of the big three wholesalers. So there's this incentive to get your hands on the cheap drugs, and then again, you mark them up if you're at whatever point you are in this chain of transactions, and move the drug along.
Gilbert, how much of this is on the internet?
Well, it's a huge and growing part of the shadow market for sure. The part that we focused on, I mean, you have to distinguish between legitimate online pharmacies, which are out there, and the ones that are primarily moving painkillers and are not legitimate for a variety of reasons.
Now, sometimes doctors become involved in writing prescriptions for people on the internet and elsewhere, right?
Generally, the way it works is that these sites are all loosely affiliated with middlemen whose function is to link the customer to a doctor who is somewhere being paid at fairly high rate to churn out prescriptions.
Warning flags raised by the Washington Post in its recent series for anyone buying drugs in ways not typical. Thanks very much, Gilbert Gall, for joining us on it.
You're welcome.
Gilbert M. Gall is co-author of the Washington Post series about what it calls the shadow prescription drug market in the United States.
According to a report in today's Washington Post, several mid-level NASA officials are expressing serious concerns about the condition of the International Space Station, serious enough that they recommended delaying last weekend's two-person launch to the station. The launch went ahead despite questions about medical equipment, inadequate air and water monitoring devices, and what some scientists called the continued degradation of the station. Joining us is Washington Post reporter Eric Pianin. He co-authored today's Post report. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
And this is a disturbing report, especially in light of the Columbia tragedy and what we now know were mid-level management warnings before that tragedy.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think in the wake of the shuttle disaster that killed seven astronauts, NASA officials said that they get it, that they now realize that they have to make profound changes in their management culture and safety programs to avert future tragedies in space. But given what we now know about conditions aboard the space station before NASA and the Russians sent up a new crew last weekend over the objections of some mid-level scientists and physicians, you have to wonder whether NASA does get it, indeed.
Well, who raised the concerns and how serious were they?
The concerns were raised by medical experts and environmental habitability people during the flight readiness process and raised those questions at a critical meeting September 10th at the Johnson Space Center. Two of those officials actually signed a dissenting opinion on a document certifying the flight. Their concern was that there was so many problems with onboard sensors that are designed to provide NASA with real-time assessment of air quality and water quality and levels of radiation. And they were so concerned about problems with the advanced life support equipment on board that they said, no, we can't support this mission. They were eventually overruled by senior officials whose major concern, I think, is to stay on schedule and to keep the space station operating with at least a skeletal crew.
And in fact, the astronauts themselves who are already there and who are going also felt that they should stay or go to the station.
Right. There's been a sort of a historical tension between the medical people on the one hand and the engineers and astronauts who are generally gung-ho about flying.
Well, Erica, you also write that the two dissenters were by Friday comfortable with the decision because assurances were made that remedies would be aggressively pursued. But you also raise the next question, which is, with the U.S. shuttles grounded, the supply route to the space station has been limited. How are they going to upgrade the space station with so few shuttles able to go there?
The reality is that they can't do a lot. There are some things that they can do to mitigate the problem, but until the shuttle fleet is flying again with its huge cargo bay that can carry up replacement equipment or spare parts, and until they're able to find the spare parts for some of these antiquated machines and equipment on board, they're not going to be able to fully address all the problems. And while some of these dissenters essentially went along with it in the end, no, they're not totally satisfied. What they're saying is, we're flying blind. It's what we don't know that worries us the most, you know, whether there's trace contaminants building up in the cabin that could sicken the astronauts or worse in months to come. They just don't know because they have no way of telling right now in real time what the conditions are on board the space station.
Hmm. Well, Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Eric Pianin, Washington Post reporter. For more information on the International Space Station, go to our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead, we'll speak to former Ambassador Peter Galbraith about lessons for Iraq from the former Yugoslavia.
There's more coming up, here and now. Thank you. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
260,000 people in the former Yugoslavia died in the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. For the most part, these days, though, the aftermath of the wars in Bosnia and Serbia and Croatia and Kosovo are off the front pages. Not that there aren't lessons there on whether places divided by religious and ethnic divides can heal, places like, say, Iraq. Joining us on the line now from Provo, Utah, is Peter Galbraith. He was the United States' first ambassador to the Republic of Croatia. Welcome, Ambassador.
Good to be with you.
Now, Ambassador, the big wars in former Yugoslavia are over. Simple question. Is anyone killing anyone there now?
Basically not, and that is a huge achievement. Bosnia had the potential to be the Middle East for Europe. That is a conflict that went on, 50 years maybe, a breeding ground for terrorism, something that preoccupied European and Western leaders when they should have been paying attention to other things. And that hasn't happened, and thanks largely to American diplomacy. Now, the task of reconstituting Bosnia as a single state where people work together, that has been much harder. And unless that is fully achieved, this is not going to be a very successful place, but I don't think the war is going to come back. And there has been progress. There's been economic progress. I visited Sarajevo a couple of years ago and was amazed to see how attractive the city looked as buildings that had been scarred by shells, burned, had been fixed up. People can move around the country. There is freedom of movement. And even some of the people who were driven from their homes have been able to return home.
But
particularly on the issue of returns, there's a long way to go.
Yeah. But Bosnians and Serbs, they all carry the same passport in Bosnia now, but they still don't like each other. It's far from what it once was, where they intermarried and sat at restaurants together.
It was a very mixed picture, even before the war. But this was not a place of teeming ethnic hatreds. But, of course, now there is ethnic hatred by the Muslims and the Croats against the Serbs who attack them, and by the Serbs who are fearful of retribution. So it's very hard to go back to what it was, say, in the 1980s.
Is it a generational thing? Does it take generations to do? And if so, what does that tell us for a place like Iraq, also divided by religion and ethnicity?
In the case of Bosnia, certainly the time is something that helps heal. The younger people are less interested in returning to their old homes because they've built new lives, and the older people who do want to return home and can't, but eventually they die out and pass on. But Bosnia also has another advantage that Iraq does not have. The European Union is expanding. It's already taking in Slovenia next year. It will certainly expand to Croatia. And when that happens, the frontiers fall. The currency that they were so proud to create disappears. It's ironic that for these countries, what they desperately wanted was to have their own flag, their own currency, their own passport, their own borders. And the second thing they want is to join the European Union and give that up. But the European Union is something that is going to transform Bosnia, just as it's helped solve in a very significant way the dispute in Northern Ireland.
Ambassador, could it all collapse, though, again in the Balkans? Are there flashpoints, or is it just unimaginable to you that it would ever go back to what it was?
It's possible that war could come back, but I think it's very unlikely. There certainly is going to be continued ethnic conflict. What we've seen in recent years in Macedonia, fighting between Albanians and Macedonian Slavs. There's a conflict in Kosovo between the small Serbian community and the Kosovar Albanians. And unless there are more meaningful returns in Bosnia, there is some possibility of renewed conflict there, but I don't see a return to the wider wars of the 1990s.
Remind us, Ambassador, how many NATO troops are there, and what would happen if they left?
Well, there were 60,000 NATO troops in Bosnia to implement the Dayton Peace Agreement. In fact, the implementation worked well. There wasn't a single NATO casualty in a hostile action. And because it came in heavy, because it came in with careful planning, it was able to reduce its numbers. Today, the numbers, I think, are in the range of about 15,000. And then there's another, I think it's around 20,000 in Kosovo.
Right.
Again, it's going to be needed for a while, but nobody's getting killed there. And it's a small price to pay not to have a Middle East situation in Europe.
Careful planning, something the Bush administration has been accused of not having in Iraq.
The contrast between what happened in Bosnia with the Clinton administration and NATO planning for I-4 and what the Bush administration did for Iraq is enormous. Every detail of the deployment in Bosnia was planned out. Each of the missions were carefully considered. There was a roadmap in the Dayton Agreement. The indexes ran 100 pages describing what would happen. And this had been thought about for several years before we got to the peace agreement. We were working in the State Department trying to work this stuff out. It was obvious in Iraq that there was no planning beyond the end of the war, no consideration of protecting buildings, key installations in Iraq from looters, no coherent planning on what kind of post-war government there would be. And I think this is one reason why it's very hard to see any reduction of U.S. forces in Iraq in the coming year. In fact, that also raises yet another point, which is that Bosnia was a multilateral effort. The United States was about a third of the initial force going in. The rest of the burden was carried by the Europeans and countries outside of Europe. Iraq is almost an entirely American venture.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Peter Galbraith is the former ambassador, the first U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Croatia.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, as Vietnam and the U.S. explore new relations, we hear from a Vietnamese businessman in Hanoi.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an amateur athlete finds out firsthand about performance-enhancing drugs.
They're very, very strange. They're very powerful. It's a bit like swallowing a freight train. You have the sense that there's something inside you that is just sort of chugging, that is not you.
And Boston's Jordan Hall celebrates 100 years of music making.
When I play in Jordan Hall, I feel like I'm playing the hall even more than I'm playing my cello.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. A series of bomb-related incidents in Iraq today. In Fallujah, a U.S. paratrooper from the 82nd Airborne Division was wounded by a blast from an improvised bomb. A bomb exploded near an oil pipeline in northern Iraq, killing two Iraqi Civil Defense Corps members and wounding 10 others. In Baghdad, Iraqi police found a car packed with explosives and arrested a Syrian who confessed to having rigged it. Another bomb found near the same location was detonated safely. Representatives from 70 nations are gathered in Madrid for a conference to raise money for Iraqi reconstruction, calling it a matter of urgency. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan says nations should set aside their differences with the United States and help rebuild Iraq. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell admits the donors' conference is likely to fall short of its $55 billion goal. President Bush has wrapped up his week-long trip to Asia. He tried to rally support for the war on terror, but was heckled when he addressed Australian lawmakers over the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Today, Saddam's regime is gone, and no one.
Senator Brown, I warn you, Senator Brown will excuse himself from the House. Senator Brown will excuse himself from the House. The sergeant will remove Senator Brown from the House.
President Bush is now on his way to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. There was no testimony today in the trial of Washington, D.C. sniper shooting suspect John Muhammad. The courthouse was closed because of a power outage caused by a faulty electrical transformer. The trial is expected to resume tomorrow. Federal agents arrested more than 300 illegal workers at the world's largest retailer early this morning. Those arrested were members of cleaning crews hired through a contractor for Walmart stores. All were in the country illegally. The arrest occurred as the workers were finishing their night shift and took place at 61 stores in 21 states across the country. A bus carrying a college sports team on its way to a tournament crashed this morning. Members of Florida A&M's cross-country team were heading to a tournament in North Carolina when their bus overturned on a highway in South Carolina. 19 people were taken to the hospital, most suffering from cuts and bruises.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
We often hear about athletes taking drugs to enhance their performance. We don't hear much about what that feels like or why they do it, despite a long list of awful side effects and dead athletes before them. Well, writer Stuart Stevens wanted to find out. An amateur cyclist, he visited a doctor who provided the drugs and then began doping himself for a big bike race. An article about his experience appears in the November issue of Outside Magazine, and Stuart Stevens joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you, by the way?
I'm quite fine. Post-drug, quite fine.
Well, as you know, Stuart, some would say dope is the operative word in sport doping. Weren't you afraid that, you know, one wrong injection, something that didn't agree with your heart or your liver, or you die in your sleep from blood packing, that's when the blood becomes so rich that it can't be pumped through the veins while an athlete is at rest, you know, that something like this happens and, you know, you're dead, but don't you feel like an idiot?
I think it would have made a great obituary, you know, like the guy who can't even cheat his way to mediocrity, but he still does.
And you were cheating. There was a race that you participated in.
Well, there was an event, this big event called Paris-Brest-Paris they have every 4 years, which is 1,200 kilometers. One of the reasons I wanted to do it, though, was there is no drug testing in this event. Mm-hmm. And there are no prizes. The first person gets the same as the last person, which is nothing.
So it was a good chance to find out what you wanted to find out, which was how did it feel? Let's first list some of the things that you took and the area that they were supposed to enhance.
Sure.
I mentioned blood packing, EPO.
Right.
How do you do that? And how
EPO is this magical elixir that Amgen came up with, which increases your red blood cells count, which increases your body's ability to absorb oxygen, which is pretty much the clinical definition of being in aerobic shape. The more oxygen you can take, the more your body can go without fatiguing itself, without producing lactic acid.
And how much did that cost?
It's expensive. I bought sort of like a case of this stuff, in essence, 12 vials, which was $2,000. And that lasted me, on the amounts that I was taking, about 4 months.
And how did you feel?
EPO actually is the only thing that I took in this whole little odyssey that makes you feel bad at first. You get these weird EPO headaches, which is something people who take this stuff, you know, cyclists and endurance athletes are well aware of. Eventually, your body adjusts to that, and you don't feel anything.
You actually started with human growth hormone.
Right.
Now,
Breakfast of Champions.
Well, was it? I mean, did you notice a difference? How did it affect your body?
Human growth hormone is something that people now take in this wonderful, weird world of anti-aging. It doesn't do anything to you quickly, but eventually, over a period of months, it will increase your body's ability to repair itself, which means you don't get as fatigued. It does, I think, give you more energy in a very subtle way because your body has more of a defense mechanism. It's also great for your skin, and it improves your eyesight in some cases. It did mine because it improves the muscles in your eyes.
Finally, you took anabolic steroids?
I took a couple of different steroids, one called DECA and one called Winstrol.
And what did they do?
They're very, very strange. They're very powerful. It's a bit like swallowing a freight train.
I've never done that, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have the sense that there's something inside you that is just sort of chugging, that is not you, that's powerful. The only thing in this little endeavor I found sort of disconcerting and ultimately freaky and somewhat frightening. I didn't take it for that long, but I gained, say, 12 pounds of muscle and reduced fat very quickly taking this stuff.
Yeah. You were over on the dark side for a little bit. I mean, in this trial that you took, could you understand that feeling of, gee, I feel so good? And could you understand how people...
Oh, yeah. It gives you an ability to become a different person. You become a different athlete. You can go longer, harder, and faster and recover more quickly. And if you do this very long, you forget that you're taking the drug. You think, well, God, this is great. This is fabulous. This is really me. Well, it is sort of you, but it's sort of not. It's you and your doctor.
Hmm. Did you feel some of those side effects that your doctor warned you that there would be? I'm thinking of with the steroids, rage, lack of sexual drive, the things that we had heard of.
You know, you can get these sort of strange swings of libido, which, you know, libido is such a kind of complicated thing, it's difficult to realize. But in retrospect now, I realize that it was affecting me. When I was taking a combination of the steroid and testosterone, I think that it affected me mood-wise briefly. You would be more aggressive, more quick to anger. Now, I was not taking very much, but there are famous instances of steroid rage. And when you see how much some of these guys are taking, I think it definitely affects you.
Hmm. And again, why did you do this? Just, to see how it feels, which is, you can hear your mother saying, would you jump off a bridge to...
I had been a rabid anti-drugs and sports advocate. But at a certain point when you see these superb athletes risking exposure and risking their health to take these drugs, you can really only come to one logical conclusion. This stuff must work. And I think my goal analytically was to understand this. Like, what is it like? What makes an Olympic athlete do this?
Risk everything to do this.
Yeah, just everything. And so now I understand it better. In a way, I have more sympathy, and I also have more scorn. Sympathy because I say, yeah, it works. And if you're competing against other athletes who are cheating and you're not cheating, you don't have a chance. I mean, I interviewed one guy who's an Olympic athlete, and he said, hey, man, you realize that if you're not cheating, you're just cheating yourself. And
it's complete reverse of what other people would say.
Sort of like this is your potential. Yeah. And people get into this strange sense that it's really a matter of will. It's if you're not willing to risk this, then you're really not willing to play the sport at its highest level. Mm. And that is a horrible, dangerous development in sports. And it's, you know, they've just had this big scandal in track and field with this new synthetic steroid that's been generated that they just realized people were taking. So I came out of it even more rabidly anti-doping and a great believer we have to support this new organization, which is the World Anti-Doping Association, which is headquartered in Montreal, which is really probably our best hope at stopping this stuff.
Stuart Stevens, thank you.
Thank you.
Writer Stuart Stevens, you can link to his article titled Drug Test by going to our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, 100 years of history at one of the country's premier concert halls, Boston's Jordan Hall.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday, the day of the week when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and share some of your thoughts.
Our segment last week on the anti-Jewish comments made by the Malaysian Prime Minister and the anti-Islamic comments made by the American general leading the hunt for Osama bin Laden prompted Patrick Womack of Locust, North Carolina, to write, "Interesting that your expert on Islam slammed General Boykin's comments while being quite delicate with the Malaysian Prime Minister's comments. Your expert went to the trouble to explain the context of the Prime Minister's comments about Jews without giving any context whatsoever to General Boykin's. That kind of bias is hard to overlook."
While our segment on unemployed youth, including African Americans and Hispanics in Chicago, prompted this call on our listener line from Trina Jackson of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
The report was unacceptably racist in its tone. And I say that because with these kind of reports, the message that always gets conveyed is that there is something fundamentally wrong with the community that you're addressing in this report. There is never any kind of acknowledgement of the structural biases that really make it very difficult for African-American youth specifically to excel and thrive in this very biased, racist system that we're living under here.
In our segment on left-handedness in humans dating back to the caveman, we asked why left-handedness hadn't evolved out of the human species. This prompted Charles Reed, a biologist in Philadelphia, to write, "Genetically speaking, any trait that is not embryonically lethal, that is, lethal to the developing organism prior to birth, will, in a sufficiently large population, persist over time no matter what. This is called the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium and is established genetic fact. Think of the equation like the village people. Not everyone likes them, but everyone must agree they are persistent in our culture."
And finally, several listeners wrote after Robin defended Christopher Cross's Sailing, a song that has made its way to many yard sales. Janet Hinton of Chelmsford, Massachusetts writes, "That is one of the few songs that makes me scramble to turn down the volume. Good for you for loving the song and not being ashamed to say so."
And we also had this from Erica Salu. "I chuckled out loud to myself when you instructed listeners not to call in and complain. Hey, I say there are classic sappy songs from the late 70s to which we can all sway. See? So let's hear it again, shall we?"
No. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Okay, for that, here's another one. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
That's cruel.
Every man wants to be a macho, macho man. Just have the kind of body, always in demand. Jogging in the morning, go man, go. Workouts in the health bar, muscles flow. You can best believe that he's a macho man. Ready to go down with anyone he can.
Hey, hey.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall is one of the most beautiful acoustic spaces in the country, some would say the world. Concert pianist Arthur Rubinstein, composer and conductor Gunther Schuller, and John Medeski of the trio Medeski, Martin, and Wood have all played in the hall that is the heart of the school. This weekend, alumni, faculty, and students celebrate the centennial of the beloved building with concerts that capture the spirit of the present while honoring the past. On October 20th, 1903, Boston's cultural elite descended from their horse-drawn carriages to enter New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall for the very first time. Eben Jordan, the hall's benefactor, watched as guests filled the new room. High arts patron Isabella Stewart Gardner was there. So was Julia Ward Howe, author of The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Soon, world-renowned composer George Whitefield Chadwick stepped to the podium to conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra's performance of his Melpomene. The audience, warmed by the hall's wood panels and detailed gold leafing, marveled at the room's amazing acoustics, considered unsurpassed even today. Jordan Hall continues to play an important role not only in the cultural life of this musical city, but perhaps more intimately, in the daily lives of the students and teachers who spend so many hours performing on the stage or practicing in the many rooms above.
I'm Dominique Eid, and I'm the jazz voice teacher here at New England Conservatory, and I started here as a student in the late 70s. I've been here in some capacity ever since. We're sitting here in a practice room. We're actually on the second floor. And for me, as a vocalist, I'm very interested in the vocal tradition, both classical and jazz. But I'm also very interested in the instrumental traditions. And all that music, as you walk around the halls, is in the air, both present and all the people who have been here. You feel the presence of them as well. And all of that kind of comes to a center at Jordan Hall stage. A couple years ago, I did a recital with some of my favorite musicians here in Boston, and one of my favorite moments in that concert was a duet I did with bassist John Lockwood. And something about singing duets in Jordan Hall is so intimate and yet not a small room at the same time. So we did a duet of the standard "You Don't Know What Love Is."
Do you know how a lost art fears the thought of reminiscing? And lives their taste of tears, lose their taste for kissing. You don't know how hearts ache for a love that cannot live yet never dies. Until you faced each dawn with sleepless eyes, you don't know what love is.
My name is Lawrence Lesser. I'm a cellist, but I've been around New England Conservatory since 1974. And in fact, we're sitting now in Jordan Hall, which is one of the greatest acoustical spaces in the world. And one of the comments about the hall, if you read the first volume of the autobiography of Arthur Rubinstein, he came to this hall in its very early days. I don't remember the year, but of all the halls he played in the United States, this was the one that he said reminded him most of the European halls. When the hall was designed, the architects turned to the standard materials that were used for great acoustical spaces, namely wood and plaster. And the nature of the acoustic really comes about because of this long ago discovered magical interplay between those two basic ingredients, plaster and wood. When I play in Jordan Hall, I feel like I'm playing the hall, even more than I'm playing my cello. My instrument becomes the hall, and when I make sounds, I listen to the sounds that come back to me from the hall, and I react in ways that only a great hall can give you to modify the sounds that I make. So it's kind of a love affair.
Hi, this is John Medeski. Most people would know me from the trio Medeski Martin Wood. I'm the keyboardist. But when I went to the conservatory, I really only played piano. Playing at Jordan Hall, it was amazing because the place sounded so incredible. And I think my very first experience playing there was doing a solo piano piece. And as a student, we used to sneak up through the back and above the stage. There are these little angels, and you used to be able to sit up there. I don't think you can get up there anymore. I tried last time I was there. They have it sealed off, but we used to go up there, and we would listen to concerts up there all the time, string quartets, orchestra concerts, solo concerts, recitals, everything. I've always called it one of the greatest halls in the world.
I'm Gunther Schuller, and many years ago I was president of the New England Conservatory. One of the great tests of a hall in terms of its acoustics is when it is asked to encompass a huge work with huge forces, because when you fill a stage with hundreds of musicians or 100 musicians or whatever, it's quite different than if it's just filled with four musicians playing a string quartet. And some halls don't work too well when you fill it full of people plus the audience. You know, it kind of dries up the acoustics. In my many years of conducting there, I think perhaps the ultimate test of the acoustics of a hall, which, as I say, are magnificent, was the performance I did in my last semester at school of Schoenberg's Gurelieder, which is a humongous work of extraordinary length and requires three choruses, four soloists, and a huge orchestra. And I can recall a little bit in my memory now, my oral memory, the hall took it very well. Amazing coincidence just occurs to me that the Gurelieder of Schoenberg were mostly composed in 1902, which is the year that Jordan Hall was being built.
Former New England Conservatory President Gunther Schuller spoke to producer Andrea Shea. For more on the centennial anniversary of Jordan Hall, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robert Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
As Vietnam and the U.S. explore new relations, we hear from a Vietnamese businessman in Hanoi.
And two new films inspired by the Columbine shootings.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.